All right, I apologize for not having a handout tonight. My computer decided to just not work the way I'm used to it working. So I need to wrestle with that more and figure that out. But we are in Genesis 35 and 36 today. And I'll put the handout out later on the website. If you really miss it or like to have it, I can print off extra copies for Sunday. But we're going to be at the very end of Jacob's story. It's not the end of Jacob's life. He'll still hang around for a little while longer. After all, I mean, Isaac is actually going to die this week when we get here. But the Genesis is going to shift from being focused on Jacob and his story and transition into focusing on the next generation and Joseph and his story. And so this is kind of the conclusion of his. And just a reminder, you know, of our theme as we've kind of been looking through Genesis is just, or the message of the whole book of Genesis is how God chooses to bless a particular people so that blessing can spread throughout the whole world and overcome the curse. So we're going to see how that blessing has kind of been fully consummated and finished in Jacob's life and is now moving on. We're also going to see how it's kind of passed on to Esau as well. Right in the beginning of 35, we kind of have in verse 1, God says to Jacob, "Arise and go to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." Now, that might seem kind of strange, like God is like talking in third person. I mean, I find it weird when people talk in third person, but God's doing that on purpose. It's not because he's just being strange or he forgot who he is. He's trying to remind Jacob of something. Because back in chapter 28, when Jacob first fled and he ran from his brother, and he was scared, he lays down right in a certain place on a rock, and he has a dream. And then he sees the angels ascending and descending on the ladder, and then God appears to him and says, I'm the God of your fathers, I'm going to keep you safe. And that's when Jacob says, okay, hey, if, you know, you bring me back to this place, and everything is good, then I'm going to build an altar to you here, and then I'll worship you, and then you will be my God. You might remember we talked about all the conditions that Jacob put on that. So this is God reminding him, hey, you remember all those promises you made? I'm still waiting. You haven't gone back to that certain place, which is Bethel. You have not built that altar, and you haven't done these things. So this is God nudging him. So when he's saying, yeah, the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau, that's God nudging him. Oh, do you remember that time? Is there anything about that maybe you have forgotten? So Jacob should know what that is. So that's verse 2, Jacob says to his household, everyone who's with him, let's put away the foreign gods that are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments. So he's commanded, he's got to go back to the promised land. And it appears to, they're not in the promised land right now. I think most likely they're still in Shechem, where they were last week in 34. After they took out the people who lived there, it seems like they're still kind of meandering, just hanging out there. And so God's telling them they need to leave and to go back. And Jacob tells them, okay, we're going to put away these foreign gods. If you're wondering where these gods came from, they probably came from Shechem, is my guess. I mean, because they just killed them and they took all of their stuff. That's a common thing that would happen. That's often why God in the Old Testament said, when you go and you take over these towns and you take over the promised land, destroy everything. Because I don't want you to take their gods. I don't want you to take their idols. So it seems like they've taken some of those. They also could have probably still had Rachel's gods that she stole from Laban and that she kept. So possibly those are some of the gods here as well. But so they're to put all of those away. They're also to purify themselves, to change their garments. It's not just a, hey, we'll throw those away and maybe we'll pick them up later. This is meant to be a kind of a significant lifestyle change that they're supposed to be making. And as they go, you know, and then says, okay, let us arise, let's go to Bethel, that I make an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress and has been with me with wherever I've gone. Jacob does good here at least. He acknowledges, yes, I need to do this, and God has kept all of his promises, that God has done everything that I've asked him to do. And God has done way more than I've asked him to do. And so they give Jacob all of the foreign gods that they have and the rings that are in their ears. So there's some kind of idolatrous idea with the rings that are there. It's not that earrings are bad, I don't think. And Jacob takes them and he buries them under the tree that was in Shechem. So they're still in Shechem there. And then as they journey in 5, a terror from God falls on the cities that were upon them. So they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. You remember last week at the end of it, Jacob was really worried. That's why he didn't want to do anything when Dinah was defiled, when his own daughter was assaulted, because he was worried. Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I can be protected. I don't know what these nations can do. They might be able to win. And then when his sons took vengeance in his own hand, he was upset about that. Well, now what are they going to do? I'm going to be a stench to them. And so all of Jacob's cowardice and his worry about what would happen seems to not matter at all, because God, it says that God protects them as they travel. God keeps them safe. God makes the other nations afraid, not because of Jacob, because of his armies, but just because God is continuing to show up and to keep them safe. God doesn't need their help. And so they journey there. Terror falls on them. Jacob came to Luz, which is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, and he and all the people who are with him. So they all go there. They all return to the promised land again, and there he builds the altar and calls the place El Bethel, because God has revealed himself to there when he fled from his brother. So he builds the altar in worship. And it's not just, we talked about altars a little bit last night in parenting group. It's really a place where he is going to make sacrifices, and making a sacrifice here. This is kind of what Abraham did before as well. And Abraham made one here before. But Bethel is a significant place. I might have mentioned this the first time we had it, but it bears repeating. Bethel is one of the most significant, if not the most significant, place of worship outside of Jerusalem. Bethel is mentioned more than any other city in the Old Testament outside of Jerusalem. So Bethel is really important, and it has begun before with Abraham, but it gets up to the next level here when Jacob makes this and says, okay, Bethel, this is the house of God. This is the place where we're going to recognize that God is, that his presence is where he dwells. And so Bethel will stay there until, you know, later with Moses, and they have the Ark and the Covenant and then the Tabernacle, and then when they wait for the temple. But even until the temple comes, Bethel is a significant place of worship. There's a number of prophets who have moments here. That Bethel is the place that Elijah goes to before he's taken up in the chariot and goes. He delays there and hangs out. The prophet Samuel has several significant moments there. There are other prophets who prophesy at that place. When Saul, before he became king, when Samuel speaks to him and says, well, go over this way and you'll find your donkeys that you've lost, that happens right here at Bethel. And, you know, it has this weird note in verse 8. Well, it seems random. Some of the stuff in these chapters seems random, but it's not. It says, and Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died and was buried under the oak near Bethel. And so he calls the place Along Bakuth, which means oak of weeping. So I wonder, oh, that's weird. Why is Deborah mentioned here? Well, somebody else who also has some ministry at Bethel is the judge, Deborah. And it mentions when Deborah is a judge, she sits under the tree of Deborah and judges Israel. I wonder, the first time you read, if you just read Judges, you may think that's kind of, you know, narcissistic, name a tree after yourself and then sit under it. No, it's not. It's this tree. The tree that Deborah dies and is buried under becomes the tree that later Deborah, the judge, will judge and preside over Israel under. So I think that's part of why that's mentioned here. At least that's the best idea I have. And then, so after this happens, after Jacob does this, he obeys immediately. So great, does everything he's supposed to do. God again appears to Jacob. And when he comes to him at Padan-Aram, he blesses him. So he blesses him again. Jacob's obeyed. He gets God's blessing. Don't obey, you don't get blessed. And so he obeys, he gets blessed again. And God says to him, you know, your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be Jacob. Israel shall be your name. This is God repeating it. Again, this is not God just like repeating himself, but it is repeating and reaffirming the promises that he has made to him, which is good. Okay, we all often have times where we need God to repeat himself to us, because we need to be reminded, oh, God does still love me. Oh, God does still care about me. Oh, God has still made these promises to me. And so God does this not because he thinks Jacob's dumb, or not because God's forgotten, but he's trying to remind him, yes, this is still true. You did not dream this. This was not all in your head. Your name's not Jacob anymore. It's Israel. This is also a significant moment because this is the last time that God is going to kind of appear physically, we think, or at least appear in the way that he does here in the book of Genesis. All the rest of the times that God is going to appear, it's going to happen in visions, and it's going to happen in dreams. Even when God comes and speaks to Jacob, it's going to say that God appears to Jacob in a vision or in a dream. So it's kind of significant. This is the last time that this happens here, but so he reaffirms it, and he says, your name shall be Israel. And God says to him, I am the God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. I am God El Shaddai. So he's, you know, affirming, I'm going to be your God. But then he also repeats the Adamic, the command made to Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. That God repeated there, and then he repeated with Noah after the flood. He then repeats it again here. It gets kind of repeated at these significant moments. Okay, you are blessed. You're continuing the blessing. Now be fruitful and multiply. Continue to let this blessing spread throughout the land. And he goes on, you know, a nation and a company of nations shall come from you. That's not that's not the same thing. This is two different things. This is God saying, not only will one nation come for you, not only will the nation of Israel, which is my particular people that I am blessing and choosing to come from you, is going to come from your loins, but also many other nations will come from your descendants as well. So that's, you know, Israel is the particular nation that God chooses in the Old Testament, but there are many other nations that God that is going to come from Israel. And he says, and kings shall come from your own body, which is an interesting phrase. Why would he say that kings are coming from his own loins? It's not just that he's going to have a king or just multiple kings from his line or the kings of nations. I think this is also foreshadowing and getting us ready for Jesus, the ultimate king who will come from Jacob's line, specifically from Judah, I think is why they... why he does this. And then he reaffirms the land. Again, the land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you. And I will give the land to your offspring after you. So it's just reaffirming the promise. The promise that I made to Abraham, the promise that I made to Isaac, I'm making that same promise to you. And this is your land. And it's not just your land, it will be your children's land. It will be your grandchildren's land. And all of your offspring after you. All of them will get to have pieces of it. So then God goes up from him in the place where he had spoke. Seems okay. Then God goes back up. And Jacob sets up another pillar in the place where he had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. And he pours out a drink offering on it and pours oil on it. And Jacob calls the place where God had spoken with him Bethel. So this is the moment Jacob names it that, we think, or at least clarifies it there. But it uses it kind of repeatedly before. Now this pillar of stone that he uses, it may or may not be the same stone that Jacob set up before. Because the last time he was here and he lay down and it was on his pillow, he then sets that up as a pillar and says, okay, well, this is the place that I've seen God. It could be the same stone that he sets back up and reconsecrates. It could be a different one because the other one got moved, rolled away. He can't remember which one it is. We don't know. I like to think it's the same one, but it doesn't specify, so we're not sure. But he does pour out a drink offering, kind of showing that he's having communion with God, not just a sacrifice, because you don't make sacrifices on pillars, but you can drink offerings are okay. And then the next thing that we have happen here is we have a number of deaths, kind of in the end of chapter 35. So on the way to Bethel, then they journey from Bethel, and they were still some distance from Ephrath when Rachel goes into labor. This is the first that we find out that she's pregnant at this moment, but she goes into labor, and she had hard labor. And where labor is at her hardest, the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for you have another son." And as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. And Rachel died and was buried on the way to Bethlehem. So they see, you know, they go to Bethel, which is where God told them to go and where God told them to build the altar. And Jacob did exactly what God told him to do. But then they appear to move on from there. But they're not going back to Shechem. They're going towards Bethlehem. So it's showing us that they're staying in the promised land. He's not going somewhere else. He's staying in the land that God has again reaffirmed. This is your land. I am giving this to you. And so he stays here. And as they're traveling, Rachel dies in childbirth. I mean, it gives us a lot of details here. I think it's significant in some way that Rachel, if you remember back when she was having her dueling pregnancies with Leah, at one point tells Jacob, "Give me a son or I will die," has a son and dies later. Doesn't happen immediately. I think there's at least some kind of connection that's going here. But so she dies in childbirth, and she wants to name him Son of My Sorrow, which is not a great name, or kind of a sad name. We can cut her some slack. She's dying. But her Jacob doesn't call him that. He keeps most of the name, but he changes the end a little bit to call him Benjamin, which is the son of my right hand. So instead of a name of sadness and shame, he gives him a more prominent name. But what is interesting, and I've mentioned this before, is that Rachel is not buried with Abraham. Rachel isn't buried with Sarah. Rachel isn't buried with Isaac and with Rebekah, and Rachel isn't going to be buried with Jacob either. She's just buried on the way. And so a question is, why? We don't fully know why. It doesn't tell us, but it does make a point to tell us this is where she's buried, so it must think that it's significant. Otherwise, we would just assume that she's buried with Jacob later, but she's not. Jacob does give her a good burial. He doesn't just leave her on the side of the road. Jacob sets up a pillar over her tomb, which is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is still there to this day. And Israel journeyed beyond it and pitched his tent behind by the Tower of Eder. So he does give her her own tomb and then sets up a pillar, which is still, in the days of Moses, there. And people can go see it. So it's a kind of large mausoleum in some way that people know where it is. But it still just raises that question of why is Rachel buried here and not over there? My opinion is that it's because Jacob knows he wasn't supposed to marry Rachel. She might be his favorite wife. He might have loved her more, but he wasn't supposed to marry her. He was supposed to marry Leah. Leah is the one who Judah comes from. Judah doesn't come from Rachel, and that's where Jesus' line comes from. I think Jacob also knows that God is not a fan of polygamy. Now, all of his other ancestors, including Abraham, had more than one wife. They're not buried with all of them. They seem to only be buried with one. And later, Jacob will be buried with Leah. And so some of this is, I think, just Jacob knowing what he can and can't do. I've also seen some say or suspect, well, maybe this is because she was worshipped foreign gods, because we know that she kept the idols, and maybe she got rid of them, maybe she didn't, and so maybe it's because she's not really a follower of Yahweh. I don't know, but I point it out because I think it's important to know. And 22, and Israel lives in that land, so he's living in the Tower of Eder. It gives us this quick little note. Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. It's also important to note here, it doesn't say that she's his wife. But Bible doesn't shy away from giving us the details of what happens, but it doesn't get explicit or tell us more than we need to know. And this is going to become an issue later. Reuben, really, because of this, is going to forfeit his birthright. Not because of foolishness like Esau, but because of his own sinful choice, because he chooses to do this. But again, we also see Israel, or Jacob, hears of this, and what does he do? Nothing. He just hears about it and kind of moves on, doesn't do anything. It appears to be his parenting style, of how he handles conflict, just ignores it and hope it goes away. That's how I approach problems at the house. Not with my children, but when Bree looked up at the wall, oh, it looks like there's water there. I think it's fine. I'm not going to look up there. If I don't look at it, then that's not a real problem. That appears to be how Israel approaches these things, which is not good. That's not how we should do it, and it's going to lead to problems later on. But it tells us that this happens here, so we're not surprised later when Jacob dies and then has something to say to Reuben. On his deathbed at the end, then he says something, which is probably a little late. But the sons of Jacob are 12, and it lists all of his sons and all of his descendants, the sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn. Again, it gives us that note just so we know how significant what Reuben has done here as well. Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and the sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin. Then the sons of Bilhah, Rachel's servant, Dan and Naphtali, the sons of Zilpah, Leah's servant, Gad and Asher, and these were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. These are all the children that Jacob had before he got back to the land of promise, where God promised to bless him. Again, just reminding us, he left with nothing and he came back with 12 children and a whole company and riches that he couldn't have imagined when he was sleeping on that rock. How God has taken care of him. And so as he's kind of continuing this journey, Jacob comes to his father at Mamre, or at Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac journeyed. So it appears he goes back to the place that his ancestors have been sojourning and journeying, and there he's there to be with Isaac in his last days. Days of Isaac are 180 years. It's a good long life, and Isaac breathed his last, and when he died, he was gathered to his people, old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Shows us again here not just that Jacob dies, but Jacob gets to die seeing, or Isaac gets to die seeing how much of the promises that God made to him are fulfilled. His son returns that he thought was lost. He probably wondered if he'd ever see him again, and now he has 12 more grandchildren. And they're going to have even more. He sees how God has blessed him. And so that's why he dies old and full of days, and he's gathered up to his people. I don't think that's just a euphemism for dying. I think that is him getting to go and be gathered with Abraham and with those who have gone before them, trusting in Yahweh, waiting for Jesus. And his sons Esau and Jacob bury him. So they both appear to have really buried the hatchet, that they are reconciled and come back together. And Esau is mentioned first and as the firstborn, which would be his right. And Jacob doesn't seem to complain about it, but they're there at that moment to do this together. And that's the end of Jacob's story. In 36, we get a long thing of Esau's genealogy. That's kind of a picture to show you somewhat. I won't try to zoom in. Of all of Esau's descendants, and there's a lot. I'm not going to read all of them, but I'm going to. I don't trust my Hebrew pronunciation. I could invite Doug to give a shot, but I don't know if I won't put you on the spot. I didn't warn you. But here it's completely focused on Esau's genealogy in his family. And this is, if you remember, this is something similar that happened with Isaac, where we got a good genealogy from Ishmael. And it showed us how God had blessed him. God made promises to Ishmael. God made promises to Hagar, and then reminds us, here's how God kept them. Here's the family tree and the list. And I think part of the reason this is here, too, is to show us partially the difference between Jacob and Esau, but also to show us that God has not forgotten Esau either. Esau is not the child of promise. Esau is not the one that God chose to give the particular Abrahamic blessing, but that does not mean that God gave him nothing. It doesn't mean that God didn't care about him, and it doesn't mean that God cast him off. God didn't care about him, I don't think he would have all these children and all of these blessings that Esau gets. And we can look at them. In a number of ways, Esau's blessed similar to Ishmael. He's lost his birthright, but his own transformation has led to blessing. I think Esau gets blessed this way because he's been changed, hopefully through an experience with Yahweh and his forgiveness of Jacob and letting go of the bitterness and being able to be reconciled and not caring, not wanting all the stuff that Jacob had to offer him, saying, no, I have enough. I don't need your things. And so because of that, God has blessed him. It tells us that he has 6 sons, which is, it's not 12, but that's a lot of kids. That's more than his father had, more than Abraham had. So he has many, and they will have many more generations. His name is going to live on. And we also see that Esau gets his own promised land, if you will. Not the promised land, not the Abrahamic promised land, but he gets his own land. Tells us in 43, at the end of it, you know, Esau, the father of Edom, and you know all these generations and all these names that are here, they're there according to their dwellings in the land of their possession. That phrase is one that is used repeatedly later in Joshua when it's talking about the conquest and the promised land. And here's all the tribes and here where they will be. And this is their dwelling place and the land according to their possession. So I think it's kind of, it's foreshadowing that, but it's also showing that God chose this other land and gave it to Esau and to his descendants as well. And Esau gets his own land without any conflict. This is another, if you don't believe me, about Esau's transformation. In 6, Esau takes his wives, his sons, his daughters, all the members of the household, his livestock, all his beasts, and all his property that he acquired in the land of Canaan. And we see, I mean, you can read the rest of the chapter. That's a lot of stuff. Takes all of that, and he goes into a land away from his brother Jacob. 4 and 7, their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. And the land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock. And he goes and settles in the hill country. That's a huge deal that just like, if you skipped this chapter, you would miss. You remember Abraham and Lot, it was kind of, you know, they had a lot of back and forth and they had conflict. And then they had to come and go, okay, we've got to split up. And here, let's pick. Let's look out. And Lot, you can pick first. I'm trusting God. And oh, okay, Lot picked the best one. Here, it seems, okay, they're already in the promised land. So it's good land. It's where you want to be. And Esau is content to take all of his stuff and to go somewhere else and let his younger brother have it. Let his younger brother have all the stuff that he's had his whole life and go somewhere else that he's never been before. That's pretty amazing. I think that happens with no fighting, no problems, no disagreements whatsoever. Esau goes to this other land. We also, as you look through things to note about Esau's descendants are filled with the chiefs of tribes. It tells us over and over, you know, these are the chiefs. There also is a number of kings who are found. In verse 31, these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom. And it also notes before any king reigned over the Israelites. They have kings before Israel does. So just a way that Esau gets some of that blessing, and Esau gets his own nation, the nation of Edom, which will later lead to some problems for Israel way down the line. But we see here in 36 how God has blessed Esau as well. And he's blessed Esau, right? Why? Not just because of how he's blessed Esau, but also because of the Abrahamic blessing. The Abrahamic covenant, the Abrahamic blessing wasn't just supposed to go to Jacob and to no one else, but it's supposed to be through a particular people, then all the nations of the world are blessed. And so because of how Esau has responded to Jacob as well, God blesses him and his own nation as well, I think, is part of what's happening here. Now, kind of some application, I think part of what we see here, and we see a lot in Jacob's life, is this idea of this kind of cycle of blessing or worship, and it's a natural cycle that we should be in through most of our lives, right, is we cry out to God because we need something, because we're desperate, because we're hurting, because we're in pain, and then God responds to us. God reminds us of his promise. This is how Jacob's story was. He goes out in the wilderness, and he cries out to God, and God responds, and God makes a promise to him. And then how shall we respond? Well, we worship. Wow, thank you. We build an altar like Jacob did, and we worship God. Thank you for being my God. Thank you for doing this. Then God keeps his promise. He does what he said he would do. And how shall we respond to God doing what he said he would do? We should respond with worship, which is what Jacob does here at the end of his story. God has done everything that he said he would do. Jacob should not just ride in the sunset, and they lived happily ever after. They won't live happily ever after, as we see in Joseph's story. But he responds with worship. And the idea here, too, is that cycle should continue. Now, because Jacob's responded with worship, God will continue to bless. And Jacob should respond with worship, and God will continue to bless. I think there's something like this should go in our own lives as well, that we should worship God all the time. Now, not just in song. Our elders talked about this a little bit in our meeting. We worship through everything that we do, and we should worship in all that we do, and all that, in every way that we follow God, not just on Sunday morning for an hour while the music is playing. But also, we should be worshiping God continually. Before he keeps his promises, after he keeps his promises, during as he keeps the promises. Some application. I think it's a reminder here. I'm reminded with Esau that those with less blessings are not forgotten by God. You might be tempted to look at your life and look at somebody else and feel like, oh, it seems like God chose them for something important, something significant, or God really blessed them, God's really given them a lot, he hasn't given me very much. Wonder if God's forgotten me. The story of Esau reminds us, no, he hasn't. Even when he obviously comes out and says before Esau's born, yeah, I'm not picking you, I'm picking your brother. But I'm still going to bless you. He still gets a lot. It's also a reminder, you know, we should worship God in response to him keeping his promises, and that we should remember that God does keep his promises. The whole book of Genesis is story after story of God keeping his promises to people. People who didn't deserve it, people who kept violating the promises, violating the commands that God asked them to do, and God blesses them anyway. And God blesses them beyond their wildest imagination. And it continues through generation after generation after generation. And the reason all of us are blessed by Jesus and what he did is because of the promise that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. And the promise that was fulfilled and kept in Jacob, and it continues through every generation to us and will continue to many generations after us, if the Lord tarries. Okay. That's Genesis 35:36. Any questions? Maybe anything I can clarify?